Jim, what are the pregame steps for a negotiation meeting that will ensure you present value in a win-win situation?
Michael, let's be sure the listener understands there is no such thing as a win-win outcome. Not only do I not believe in it, I've never seen it. What I do see is we're able to move our long-term aim, our mission and purpose forward. And if the other party is able to move their objectives or their purpose forward, that has to be their decision. I can't make that decision for them. All I can do is try to move my mission and purpose forward to their benefit. So I don't believe in win-win, and that's a very important piece to the pie. There are critical steps. That's how we coach negotiations, by preparing our checklist and then executing that checklist. And then we also have a complete way to debrief to prepare for the next checklist. So it's an ongoing chain of events process. So I'll run down through the checklist, the points in the checklist, and maybe that'll stir their imagination to do this. But we start with a mission and purpose. And Webster defines mission as long-term aim and purpose as continuing task and responsibility. So we have to define what our long-term aim is and our continuing task and responsibility. And there can be multiple mission and purpose statements throughout the negotiation, because each negotiation, each step, one bite at a time, has its own smaller mission and purpose under the umbrella of the overall. So that's an important thing. It has to be developed. It's the giant secret to great negotiating success. Secondly, we have to identify the real problems we see that are holding us back from any opportunity for success. So whatever problem we see, whether it be past performance, pricing, whatever it is, it has to be dealt with. We can't allow ourselves to try to move through a negotiation by hiding the elephant in the room. That problem's got to be not only identified, which is very hard to do, it takes a lot of work and a lot of practice, but also to negotiate it out of the negotiation so it's gone, it's eliminated, it's fixed. Next, we have to know exactly what we want in the negotiation. And that's a very difficult thing to come up with. You'd be shocked, Michael, at how many people I've coached over the years who, when I asked what they wanted, they said, well, I just want the deal. And they had no concept of breaking it down step by step to get to the contract signing. I mean, I've coached negotiations for hundreds of millions of dollars that have taken 2 and 3 years to consummate. So they have no comprehension of that and what they want and how to break that down. And then next, in our preparation, we always have an idea. And now we don't have to have a full picture, but based on the results as we execute the checklist, we have to know what we want to have happen next, because that's going to be the bridge to the next negotiation, if there's going to be one. Then we have to have laid out all of our behavioral goals, all the statements we're going to make, all the questions we're going to ask. That all has to be scripted out. Now, that sounds like a big event, like writing a speech, but it's not, because you'll find all the speaking points will come up as you prepare the checklist. Then we establish our activity goals, who's going to do what in the negotiation in a meeting, so we have everybody on the same page. If we have one person talking on this area, another person talking on this area, they know that assignment, and that's an activity goal that we set. And then lastly, we prepare with critical research. Now, critical research is a difficult thing in that most people run to the internet, read what's said on the internet, and they think they know the adversary. And sadly, that's not the case. Those are our steps we take. That gets us started into the negotiation when we're preparing, getting going.
All right, so this next question is pretty relevant to that, and it's, how do you determine the real criteria of your adversary if maybe doing internet research isn't enough, so that you know whether a successful negotiation is even possible?
That comes down to your behaviors in the negotiation and your capabilities of asking the right questions in the right way to bring about the creation of vision and uncovering hidden agendas. And we have tools to do that. For example, we teach a thing called 3+, but there's some critical points to 3+ that are oftentimes overlooked. For example, you cannot execute 3+ without being a nurturing person with a mission and purpose in place. So if you don't know how to do that, it's going to come off badly. So those behaviors to uncover the hidden agendas and the real challenges and the real vision you want to get, that's really the key.
Can you give me a little peek into the window of what the 3-plus strategy is?
I had a client, a chief financial officer, and we were working on a contract in Korea in a Silicon Valley company, a big giant out there. And we had a Korean adversary that was disingenuous. At least we thought he was disingenuous, because in the past, when we executed a 3-plus, the answers never came back the same. So 3-plus is the ability to stay around a topic and comfortably three or more times as the adversary lays out the vision around that point. So we designed in the checklist a series of interrogative questions, simple, short, how will that work, what will it look like, those kinds of things. And we got to 14 plus with this Korean CEO.
14 plus questions?
14 plus. We stayed around the topic of the contract 14 times. And the importance of the contract was a topic. And Bob actually counted the number of times he went back to it in the negotiation over a couple hours. And finally, this Korean CEO said, well, the contract's never going to be valid because I'm going to break it within 6 months anyway. The hidden agenda all along was to break the contract within 6 months. And once he'd gotten the funding, was to force my client into Korean court for the next 3 or 4 years to get it resolved.
But the 14-plus, that strategy by staying on the topic of the contract, did that drive him to reveal his hidden agenda?
Yeah, exactly. It peels back layers of onion, and you can't hide. It's exactly like the FBI or some of the great interrogators of the world who are able to put a criminal down. You know, you ask them the first time, where were you on the night of December 2nd? They'll say, well, I was at my mom's house. And, well, when you were visiting your mom's house on December 2nd, what did you and your mom talk about? Well, we talked about, you know, family things and et cetera, et cetera. And then, well, we're a little confused because in your written statements to these questions, you said you were at your mom's house on December 1st. What are we missing here? So lo and behold, over time, by 3, 4, 10-plussing, that's what plus is all about, at least 3 times, but more, you start to bring out the truth. You start to uncover the hidden agendas. And it's not a matter of sticking around that topic until you've got 14 questions asked. That's not the case. You ask early on, then you go to another problem, discuss it, and you say, you know, let me go back. You know, how does it apply to the validity of the contract? So you actually move around and come back to it. And he was absolutely flabbergasted when that Korean CEO said, we're going to break it anyway, and then we'll just spend the next years in court. And Bob had said he didn't realize what he said. I left there, and he didn't even realize he had told me the truth, what his deepest thoughts were. He didn't even know it. And of course, we didn't sign the contract, and, you know, we moved on. But I think that was the greatest, most blatant example. And I remember the board of directors, Bob and I were in the board of directors meeting talking about this, and they looked at us like, you guys are crazy. You know, you were just lucky. That was their whole attitude. And, of course, who are we to try to sell what we're doing to them? You know, I mean, they're the board of directors, so we just said, well, we just hope we get another opportunity to do it again. We did many opportunities, but they always shook their head like, how'd you do that?
That's excellent. Great story. When approaching big companies for the first time, what prospecting strategies can one use to maximize your positioning, you know, from the beginning?
Approaching a big company, I guess the question is, what are we approaching them for would be my question. And the key is going to be, okay, if we know what we're approaching them for, whether it be service, a product, something, no matter what it is, you know, we have to develop that mission and purpose we talked about in our preparation. In order to penetrate anywhere, that mission and purpose is the secret weapon, as we talked about. So by having that in place and knowing the problems, the real problem is if they don't know you, that's a real problem. And that has to be dealt with right up front. So, for example, look, my purpose here today is to introduce myself. The problem is you don't know me, and you don't know our organization and really what we do. And then the question is, Miss Lobby Attendant, I'm wondering who I should speak to in this arena. What assistant should I go to introduce myself? So it's a whole negotiation just approaching an organization like that. I usually encourage my clients, we usually do it by telephone, and we usually start with the assistant of the CEO so that we find out who we should talk with. Then that becomes part of our negotiation. We were directed to you by the assistant to Mr. Smith, the CEO, and I'd like to wonder when I could set a time to talk with Mr. Jones. So that's normally the way we'll begin that.
How do you decide what your limits are or what your limits would be in the negotiating process, and what parameters do you set up to adjust your approach if the process is not moving in the direction you need it to move in?
that's a question that, again, comes out of the win-win ivory tower that makes no sense to me. Again, I don't set those limits, how much I'm allowed to spend. I'm more interested in the vision of what they can deliver and what they will charge me for it. If they can't create the value for me in vision and I don't see the value, then I can't say that I have a price that I would pay for that. And one of my rules, Michael, for myself, now this is my personal self. When I have someone I'm negotiating with for my company, if it's a service provider or an artistic person, a person that their abilities, their talents, I'm counting on, if they can create the vision of what they're doing and its value, I always pay the asking price. I never undermine or attempt to drive their price down if they create that vision. And I'll tell you why. I learned this from my father. If you want people to be responsible, all you have to do is pay their asking price. And then it's their responsibility to deliver. Once you begin to cut their price or drive their price down, if there's any glitches or failures, it's your fault because you demanded this price and I'm finding out I can't deliver what I thought I could. So that's kind of my personal take on all of that. I don't set a limit when I'm buying. You know, I have a price when I'm selling, and my price is never compromised. Now, I know the listening audience isn't going to believe that, and that's okay. But everything I deliver is personal talent and service, and if I discount that, I don't like myself. I don't feel good about what I'm doing. And if I don't like myself and what I'm doing, then I'm not going to perform to my highest level of capability.
If you beat someone up on price and then they relent and give you their product or service or expertise at a lower price, they're losing in a way, and that animosity is set, and they may not deliver the value you would have gotten if you paid the regular price they were asking.
That's exactly right. Now, I'm not saying that you go out and buy a car and pay the very highest price, but I've got to tell you, Michael, it's very easy to do research on a car. For example, my wife insisted on getting a hybrid SUV from GM. First of all, to help GM. All the citizen reasons, help GM, help the taxpayers of the country recover their investment, hybrid, save the environment, all of that, and that's fine. She went on the internet, did her research, found out what the car normally sold for, what the list price was, and I went with her to the dealer, and she said, what do I do? I said, you know what the car is selling for around the country, and you tell them it's okay if they don't want to take this, but you write a check, hand them the check, for the amount you're paying that's based on your research around the country. And they're free to reject that. But you expect great service, but they're free to reject that. And they said, oh, no, man, that's a good number. We'd actually given you a little more. And she said, well, I want you to remember me when I come for service. So her mission and purpose, though she paid probably $200 more, believe me, Michael, when she calls service and says, this is Mrs. Camp calling about my hybrid, I need an appointment as quickly as possible to change the oil. Please, Mrs. Camp, bring it right in. We'll give you a loaner while we change the oil. So her mission and purpose was very clear, and she gets great, great service, and she paid them a little more than they would have asked.
Yeah, that's a good example. I'm sensing a lot of the students are struggling with how to approach someone in a negotiation. So Diane here asks, before you can negotiate, how do you get people to hear your proposal? How do you ask for the opportunity for 10 or 20 minutes of their time to present something of value and then negotiate?
If you don't fit into their world, why would you waste their time? And what can you do in 20 minutes? You know, I love the comment of great value to you. I only need 10 minutes, Michael. Let me show you what I got. Give me a break. You know, if it's of great value to me, how can you do anything in 20 minutes?
What they're trying to do is just get a chance to at least impress them with something. Just get a little bit of their time so they can get in the door.
If they really want to impress someone, all they've got to say is, look, my name is Betty Smith. I have no idea if what I do fits in your world. And if I don't, just tell me because I don't want to waste your time. But I specialize in this, or we specialize in delivering this. What's the greatest challenge you face in this arena? Get into their world, their vision, and find out what their challenges are. But you've got to have the tools, Michael, to be able to do that. Now, we have a whole series of what we call cold calling prospecting training that we do for people in that arena as part of our courses in the university and our training package. And, you know, for every person that we call out of the white pages of the phone book with a common product that goes to that arena, we average 3 appointments out of every 10 contacts.
You know, I was reading that press release this morning, the one you sent me, but it said that it was credentialized study and that it was being taught at Harvard and some of the other universities?
That's right. We're required reading at Harvard and NYU, USC, UCLA, University of California, Columbia. The list goes on and on.
And this is the Start With No book?
That's right.
Jim, when you're going into negotiations, I don't suppose that you do this without considerable investigation beforehand. How much time and effort do you spend in research prior to meeting with all the parties? Two, do you use a research team? And three, if so, how do you hire them?
First of all, we don't use a research team. We do our own research. Second of all, we don't use the easy-to-acquire website research. We don't go to a company website and read all the well-written words. We're looking for articles. We'll do a lot of work in a Google, but we do it ourselves, and we're looking for key things. But more importantly, we're constantly engaged. We engage, and we're doing research while we're engaged. And we'll uncover things during the engagement in casual conversations. We're always on. Our minds are always going. We're always taking notes. So our research is actually taking place as we're performing and executing in the negotiation. But again, so many mindsets out there, when they ask these questions, Michael, they have a give-and-take mindset, and they can't comprehend speaking about 10 or 15, maybe 20% of the time, and listening 80 or 90 because they're busy presenting. They're trying to get 20 minutes to show them what they've got. They're busy arguing over why and justifying their price. It's all a waste of time. It's not what we do.
Okay, if you're doing research on a person with whom you'll be negotiating a large contract with, and you do this research by contacting individuals who know your negotiator well, what questions do you ask and why?
I would like to know, what kind of person is Tom? How long has he been doing what he's doing? What's his background? Where does Tom come from? Those kinds of general questions, and I listen, and I take good notes. And I'll 3+ each one of those. The more information comes out, the better. I was negotiating this morning with a head of sales for an industry giant who wanted to introduce me to a head of sales of another company. I said, tell me about him. He said, well, we've been friends since fifth grade. Wow. He said, oh, yeah, we grew up together. I said, yeah, tell me more. Well, we played ball together. We went to high school together. He's like a brother to me. He'll do anything I say. I told him I wanted him to talk to you. But I had all that research accomplished in 20 minutes from someone I'd known him from fifth grade. He loved to study this in college. He married a wonderful girl from here. You know, she went to this university. His major was this. Hers was that. Those kinds of things.
Jim, I've heard it said that your goal should be to initiate win-win negotiating, but what do you do if the other guy is only interested in win-lose negotiation?
Well, what's really sad is I've never said the result should be a win-win objective. That's weak on its best day. That's not what we do. And as far as win-lose goes, losing is up to you. I don't believe in winning, and I don't believe in losing a negotiation. I believe in moving our objectives forward, our mission and purpose forward, our long-term aim. And I believe in delivering what we have prepared as a mission and purpose for the other party. So I don't get into this win-win thing at all. And again, we're responsible for a failed mission and purpose. I mean, if we're going to go backward, why would we even make an agreement that's going to take us backward? I would say that it's our decision to say, no, we can't accept that. And so, to me, there is no such thing as a lost negotiation. They're just moving on.
Mark wants to know, Jim, what is your best technique to turn things around when you're in the middle of a negotiation and there seems to be an insurmountable impasse? How do you keep going even if it appears that your interests seem to be at opposite ends?
It's really very, very simple. I ask the other party, how do we solve this? What would you recommend? And if they tell me it can't be solved, you know, what am I going to do? About the only thing I can do is thank them very much and say, look, down the road, if anything changes, let's revisit this. But I'm not going to make an agreement that's going to put me back 2 or 3 years. And if we're at such an impasse, if I know their pain, their problems, their challenges, and I know I can solve them, if I can't create the vision around that, shame on me. So if there's an impasse, if I know those things, there can never be an impasse. The impasse has come when we don't know what the real challenges are, and we don't have a solution that we've helped them discover. So it's really our fault.
Jim, I know that business is competitive, but do you think that there is room for a true win-win negotiation where both sides are open and honest so that they can both get what they want and not feel like one is getting screwed? After all, when you make an enemy, you can't do business with them ever again, so you are really the loser even though you thought that you were smart.
That's the whole myth of win-win. You've got to be a nice guy. You've got to be well-liked. And therefore, when you're well-liked, you know, you're not creating an enemy. So we better give what they require. We can afford it this time. And therefore, next time, things will be better. And all we're focusing on is what we want and trying to get as much as we possibly can for what we want. We're not focused on what we're delivering to them. You know, there's a great story. In fact, I'm in the middle of it right now about Neville Chamberlain and Hitler.
Who is Neville Chamberlain?
He was the Prime Minister of England when Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia. Neville Chamberlain literally gave out of a desire to be liked, a desire to not make waves. He literally tried for a win-win solution with Germany that started World War II. It's a sad commentary on win-win. And I've got to tell you, I know from experience during the Vietnam War, all this desire to be good people, to be liked, to be reasonable, if you will, the bombing halts against North Vietnam and the stopping of waging war only empowered North Vietnam, our enemy, to rebuild and gain heart from our weaknesses. And so in the situation in Vietnam we ended up in because of our weaknesses of helping create vision of what could be. My goodness, if we'd have gone into Vietnam, into Ho Chi Minh's office and sat down and said, look, let's do this. Let's talk about how we can create a much greater country in Southeast Asia. There was never any vision created. It was all about win-win, give and take, and it just created a war. So I hear these kinds of comments, can't we just be friends? I'll tell you, Michael, this is really a key. No one has a friend that they don't respect. Respect is the key ingredient, not being liked. I can't get anyone to like me. I have a hard time getting my wife to put up with me, let alone like me. But respect is the key ingredient. It's the foundation to all business relationships. And if I say no to one of my clients, you shouldn't do that. No, I can't support that. You're making a big mistake, and here's why. What happens when this happens? What happens when that happens? Even though they don't agree with me, they respect me. And that's how business relationships grow. We just had a situation in China where we had a purchasing agent and a salesperson who, unfortunately, is a win-winner and wanted to give him the store. So they actually gave him a $7 million discount. And thank goodness the purchasing agent rejected it because he thought he could get more. And this was on the mainland of China with a Chinese salesman on our side and a Chinese buyer on their side. And they're supposed to be master negotiators. Here's our salesman giving in to millions of dollars, and thank goodness the purchasing agent rejected it because we pulled the whole thing off the table. And then we went to the real decision makers and created the vision of this kind of discounting that your purchasing people are demanding. There's not going to be R&D. What will you do with the next generation of technology? What will you do when it's not delivered because we can't do the research and development to bring it forward? Michael, they paid full price to get that research and development done. It's really true. I talked to the engineers. I said, wait a minute. If we give up $7 million of margin in this arena, what are the ramifications? And one of the engineers said, well, we've got to cut research by 80%. We'll never get the new technology to market in a reasonable time frame.
So you kept it in their world.
Absolutely.
So their vision was, we're not going to have research and development on the next wave of technology.
And without that next wave of technology, we're going to lose market share. And so this whole being locked into what we want and this, quote, we want to win, Michael, that's such an emotional arena, and it's already emotional 100%. And then you drive, I need to win. I need to win at any cost. I mean, I've seen sales guys come back out of the field. I've seen lawyers come back from negotiations and lawsuits and say, look, all we got to do is give up 20% of this, and we got to win. And the whole focus is on winning. And it's a sad state of affairs when people think that's real negotiation.
How and when do you know it's time to walk away from the negotiations without an agreement? How do you know when to quit?
It's very simple. In my case, I have my mission and purpose in place, very clearly in place. And if it's not going to move my mission and purpose forward, my long-term aim, my continuing task and responsibility for my organization, then I'm not going to be able to do it because I'm not going to move it backward.
this seems like one of these sales techniques, but this gentleman wants to know, what is the best phrase to say when walking away from the deal to get the last chance best offer from your negotiating partner?
I'll give him a phrase because it's true. I'm glad you said no to this. I'm glad it doesn't fit. I would never want to harm you by asking you to take something that doesn't fit. If I can ever help in the future, please, I hope you'll give us a call.
That's good. All right, how about this one? What do you do if the person with whom you're negotiating with himself is a master negotiator? What do you do?
I have fun. It's a great, great event.
I bet it is.
I'll tell a very quick story. I had a great negotiator from one of the largest consulting firms on the earth.
This is someone you were negotiating with?
That's negotiating for my services. And he called me up and he said, you know, Jim, my name is Joe Smith and I've been at this now for 30 years. I'm the head of procurement for XYZ Consulting and you know we're probably the largest organization in the world, so I'm pretty good at this. He said, I'm going to really enjoy this.
He told you he was going to enjoy it?
Yeah, and I said, gee, that's great. I'll keep my guard up, and I kind of laughed.
When you're negotiating with a guy like that, do you see his game?
Yeah, it's funny. It's kind of sad, actually, but I just laughed and said, don't worry, I'll keep my guard up. And I said, but, you know, I'm kind of stuck in the middle here of a call on the other line, and I didn't actually expect this. Could we schedule a time a little later today and we can get together on this? He said, oh, sure. So we set a time, and he called me back. Of course, in the meanwhile, I'd prepared a checklist. Oh, yeah, I did a little critical research and made my own checklist. I had a mission and purpose.
What was the mission and purpose?
To provide them the greatest opportunity to expand their horizons in negotiation and improve their bottom line.
Was there anything important you found in the research to develop that checklist?
Yeah, they had two down quarters in a row. I found that out, and I also found out there had been a shakeup in upper management. A CFO had been replaced. And a few other things. But the point was is that great negotiator was going to call me. And he called me, and he was trying to use the hammer and anvil tactic of win-win.
Give me an example.
The greatest company in the world is your competitor, meaning so they're the hammer, I'm the anvil, and they're going to beat me with that great competitor, right? So he called me and said, you know, Jim, let's cut to the chase here. I love it when people say that to me. And I said, oh, sure, of course. Go right ahead. So, of course, he's talking. I'm listening, taking notes. He said, now look, we've done our research. I know you've talked to a couple of our senior VPs over the last 2 or 3 months. And he said, we've decided it's between you and Harvard for negotiations training. I said, gee, that's really interesting, but you can't hire me. You can't dare hire me. I'm dead in the water.
You said you can't hire me. Why?
Your career's at stake here. You can't take a risk on a small company like mine compared to the greatest academic institution on the planet. You can't use me. And Michael, here's what he said. He said, absolutely. He said, you know, I've been given permission to hire either one of you. I said, let me just ask you, why in the world would you take the risk to hire me in this arena? He said, well, because everybody in the company knows that the Harvard stuff doesn't work.
Yeah.
He actually said that. World's class negotiator. It was bizarre. And he said, now, Jim, Harvard's going to do this. Their pricing is $400,000 over a year's time. And they're going to travel around the world for $400,000 and do two-day workshops all over the world. I said, well, that's not what I do. I said, I teach a system, and then I coach that system, and I utilize the internet, the telephone. But workshops and travel are a waste of time. Now, I'll do the workshop as introductions, if you like, and pricing, I'm going to have to charge you upwards of $14,500 a person. He said, what? I said, the price of coaching, you know, it's very intense and it's very demanding. And if you're just looking for workshops, I just can't do that and not produce results. It wasn't even in the ballpark, Michael. There were 100 people to be trained. It was a whole different world, and they hired me.